Hi, Patrick Cox here in Boston with a spacey World in Words.
Space, the final frontier.
You could say that in Italian, too.
Spazio, ultima frontiera. Eccovi i viaggi dell'astronave Enterprise durante la sua missione quinquennale diretta ad esplorare strani mondi.
So let us boldly go where no podcast has gone before in search of the polyglot Trekkie. Aside from foreign star trekking, we have today the story of an American GI and linguophile who never came home after World War II, and something on Germans who misquote Winston Churchill. The World, the radio show I work for, is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 260 stations around the United States. Listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out all of our other podcasts. We're on Facebook. There's a World in Words Facebook group, or you can email me. That address is language@pri.org. So before we enter the multilingual world of Star Trek, and before we misquote Winston Churchill, we're going to hear about Americans in France. Is it a love-hate thing, this relationship between Americans and the French? Well, not this week, just love. We have the story of an American World War II soldier who loved the French language and stayed in France after the war ended. First, translator Anne Ishii. Anne actually translates from Japanese into English for a living. You can hear all about that in The World in Words number 34. But she also had a great love of French and what she thought of as the French lifestyle. Here she is talking about that.
The French I learned was in high school, and, you know, like a lot of, I think, fanciful high school girls, there was this romantic idea of, like, me one day being in France with a French boyfriend who wears a beret, and I would have coffee every morning, you know, on the streets of Paris or something like that. And so that was my initial motivation for choosing French of the three foreign languages that were offered to us that we had to take. My teacher was the most amazing teacher I had ever had. He and I actually maintained a friendship after I graduated. And I think that has a lot to do with most people's, you know, lifelong obsessions is, you know, their first teachers in whatever it is. I know that's why I have several friends who to this day don't know how to swim because the swimming teacher in their PE class is really terrible or whatever. But in any case, it was a really good high school teacher that really got me attached to the language. And then I studied it in college. I went to France several times and then I lived there for a couple years.
Have you done anything with your French? I mean, I speak as somebody who speaks Danish. I've done nothing but have fun conversations with my friends. But have you kind of used your French in the way that you've used your Japanese?
I wish. I've actually offered translation services from French to English, but I really can't compete with the translators that are doing French to English. That's like trying to be, you know, like a Major League Baseball player for me. I guess the closest thing to doing anything with my French is having French boyfriends. I mean, yeah, doing the French is the only thing I've done with my French.
New York-based translator Anne Ishii, who ended up putting her French to good use. Great line, Anne. I'll post a link to her very entertaining blog at the World in Words Facebook page and at patrickcox.wordpress.com. So now, an American in France, part deux. This American was among the hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers who fought in Europe during World War II to repel the Nazi threat. Alan Cope, though, didn't return home when the war ended. He stayed in France all of his life. And we know about Alan Cope largely due to an encounter he had in 1994 with a French cartoonist named Emmanuel Guibert. As a result of that meeting, the two became friends, and Guibert eventually brought Cope's story to life in a graphic novel called Alan's War. The book has been translated into English, and it's now published in the United States. From Paris, here is reporter Cyrus Farivar.
Alan's War came out in France in 2000. That was the year after Alan Cope passed away at the age of 74. In his Paris apartment, Emmanuel Guibert flips through some of the hundreds of sketches and watercolors that he did over nearly 5 years in preparation for Alan's War.
This is an apple pie recipe. So I have drawn his hands doing everything. And I must say that I've never tried since his death to do the recipe myself, because I'm not a cook. But normally, with everything that I have drawn, I would be able to reproduce the recipe, because I've tried to draw everything.
Guibert's notebooks are filled with drawings of Alan Cope's house, his dog, his car, and especially the man himself. The two first met in 1994 and became close friends. They met on Ile de Ré, a small island off of France's southwest coast, where Cope had been living in retirement for years and where Guibert had been on vacation. Within a few days after their first meeting, Guibert says that the two of them took a walk on a beach, and Cope told him, entirely in French, the story of how he experienced the war and ended up in France.
When I felt that he had said more or less what he wanted to say, the first silence after these 45 minutes or this hour between us, first silence that occurred, I said, we have to make a book. He said yes.
The story is fairly simple. It tells of a young 19-year-old Californian who ends up in the American army to fight Hitler. Along the way, he meets a lot of interesting characters, learns about post-war European life, and discovers music, art, and literature. In essence, it's a very small story about one man. Guibert says that while the American English translation would lose the charm of Cope's French as he spoke it, Guibert wanted the story to retain its intimacy.
But in the American one, I really wanted the translation to be as natural as possible. It comes out very naturally. The confidence is really fluent. It's really like sharing a glass of beer with someone, and that's what I wanted.
The smallness of the story comes out not only in the way it's told, but also in the way the images are drawn. That's according to Jeet Heer, a Canadian journalist who specializes in comics. In scenes involving large groups of soldiers, the faces and features of the others are blurred, making them seem like faceless masses. Heer says the specific format of comics makes this possible.
I think also, in some curious way, that the stylization works partially because war is such a dehumanizing experience. That's an effect that you really see in Alan's War. You can make him out, but a lot of the soldiers are very sort of these stylized figures of soldiers, and that actually sort of does capture something true about the experience of war.
Cope witnessed entire towns that had been destroyed by war, which seemed to lead him to a life of humanity. He filled his own life largely with music, literature, and art. He even started to write his own poetry later in life. Guibert says he's now working on a prequel to Alan's War. He hopes to explore Alan's childhood growing up in Pasadena, California in the 1920s and 30s, based on what Cope himself told him and on what he's found out on a recent research trip back to California to explore Alan's roots. He hopes to finish the next chapter in Alan Cope's story in the coming years. For The World, I'm Cyrus Farivar in Paris.
Cyrus sent me some outtakes of his interview with French cartoonist Emmanuel Guibert. I was especially interested in hearing more about the charm of Cope's French and how Guibert could represent that in his images. Guibert became a close observer of Cope's French because he recorded their conversations and listened back to them as he was writing Alan's War. He says it's clear that Cope didn't learn his French in a classroom.
He self-taught French by reading, by immersing himself in France. And plus, he liked language a lot. It's funny, if you listen to our tapes, very often he stops the tape because he's looking for the correct word, and he wouldn't use another. So it may last 3 minutes, but he will find it. And I would try to help, and he would be mad at me. No, please, leave me alone. And I liked that a lot, because it's precise, and in the precision of words, there lie the images. So it's a very precious place for me, because it's from his words that the images would be born. And we shared the same love and respect for language. I really think if there's a meaning in our lives, it's in the relationships between all of us. And the vehicle of this relationship is mostly language. So we'd better know the correct words, because they're very important.
Of course, there's an irony here about Cope's precision with words. Like it or not, his French was always going to be that of an outsider. And it wasn't just his language that gave him away. For one thing, he wore blue jeans and striped shirts.
For the French, especially for the French who would live in his island, he was, till the very end, the American. But if you, as an American, would have met him, you certainly would have seen how European he had become. And that's always the position, not always easy, in which exiled persons are. In the end, they're from nowhere. or they can feel like it sometimes. And they're not anymore from the country where they come from, and they'll never be from the country where they live.
Well, I can relate to that. We have the story of another American in France in a future podcast, possibly as soon as next week. It's another great story, a kind of exposé of the French system for selecting and training English teachers. Now, it probably hasn't escaped your notice that the new Star Trek movie has just been released. And in many parts of the world, as I speak, it is the number one box office hit. So let's enter some kind of black hole, go back in time to the original TV show starring the great William Shatner as Captain Kirk. Now, that was a worldwide hit as well, just like the current movie, and it got dubbed into a bunch of languages. I'm going to play you clips from the same scene, first in English, then in a few other languages, not, I'm afraid, including Klingon. It's a conversation between Captain Kirk and superhuman tyrant Khan from a 1967 episode. The dubbed versions are probably from a few years later. Here's the original.
You are an excellent tactician, Captain. You let your second-in-command attack while you sit and watch for weakness. You fled. Why? Were you afraid? I've never been afraid. But you left at the very time mankind needed courage. We offered the world order.
Now the same dialogue in French.
Vous êtes un excellent tacticien, capitaine. Vous laissez votre second diriger la conversation. Pendant ce temps, vous guettez mes faiblesses.
Vous vous êtes enfui, vous aviez peur?
Je n'ai jamais eu peur.
Mais vous vous êtes enfui au moment même où l'humanité avait besoin de votre courage.
Nous voulions un monde en or.
And now here it is in Spanish.
Reconozco, capitán, que es un excelente estratega. Permite que su segundo de a bordo ataque mientras usted se dedica a buscar debilidades.
¿De qué huyó? ¿Tenía miedo?
Nunca he tenido miedo.
Pero huyó en el preciso momento en que el hombre necesitaba coraje.
Ofrecimos al mundo un nuevo orden.
And Italian.
Allora le sue simpatie andavano...
Lei ha una tattica eccellente e raffinata, capitano. Lascia che il suo secondo attacchi, mentre lei, seduto, osserva quali sono i punti deboli.
Lei è scappato, aveva paura?
Io non ho mai avuto paura.
Lei è mancato quando l'umanità voleva coraggio.
Noi offrimmo al mondo l'ordine!
And finally, German.
Sie sind ein exzellenter Taktiker, Captain. Sie schicken Ihren ersten Offizier in die vorderste Linie und beobachten aus der Deckung, ob der Angriff erfolgreich ist.
Dann verstehe ich nicht, warum Sie geflohen sind.
Ich bin nicht geflohen.
Aber Sie haben die Erde zu einer Zeit verlassen, als die Menschen Hilfe brauchten.
Wir wollten diese kranke Welt heilen.
That German dub is particularly interesting. It's not a direct translation of what Khan actually says in English. Remember what he says. We offered the world order. That's a little too close to what Germany claimed to offer the world in the 1930s. So the line was changed in the German version to, we wanted to heal a sick world. I played all of these versions to the big show's William Troop. William is a little bit of a Trekkie, and he speaks several languages. In fact, all the languages I've just played except German. Here's what he thought of what he heard.
The German one struck me as the one that had the most emotion in it, and the one where, even though I didn't understand the words, I could really feel the character. For example, when the bad guy gets angry, you could really feel that emotion in the German dub of the scene, whereas in some of the other languages, the emotion was downplayed more. And one thing that I noticed in hearing these languages one after another, these dubs one after the other, you know, the stereotype is that there's more emotion and more feeling in the language are the ones where the dubbing ends up sounding a little more subdued and emotionless almost. So I'm talking about Spanish and Italian were almost the ones where the dub, you kind of feel like, well, it's kind of quiet in there and, you know, nobody's getting too angry.
Why do you think that is?
And I think what that says is all about the dubbing culture in Italy and in Spanish-speaking countries. I presume this was in the 1970s sometime when it was dubbed. And I was growing up in Italy and Mexico in the 1970s. And I remember TV shows, any kind of American TV show being dubbed. So I would watch these shows and they all would have that same tone where people would be talking like this and they would not really have a lot of emotion in their voice, even if the scene calls for a lot of emotion. It would be kind of a monotone. So I think that's something that, at least in Italy and Mexico where I grew up, all shows were dubbed that way. And I think it's moved on since then. But there was a culture where that's just how a professional dub actor would sound.
Wow. And it's so strange that the German one, I mean, I agree with you. I didn't understand as much of any of them as you did. But the German one, definitely, it stayed with me. I mean, the bad guy, maybe because of our own stereotypes about Germans playing bad guys. But
the bad guy just seemed that much more evil.
Yeah, it seemed like he really sounded evil in that scene.
Yeah, Mr. Creepy German. Well, William, thank you very much. And I have one thing to say to you. Live long and prosper.
Very good. Thank you.
The Big Show's William Troop. We'll hear from William again at the end of this podcast when we eat sideways. Now, just so no one thinks that we have it in for the Germans, here's a little thing about Germans that I find quite endearing. Germans, just like a lot of people, like to quote from Winston Churchill. That's the endearing bit, given the role that Churchill played in defeating them in World War II. But here's where the Germans are different. Their Churchill quotes, at least some of them, are made up. They're urban legends. Christoph Drösser writes for the German newspaper Die Zeit. He told the Big Show's Lisa Mullins about some popular sayings that his fellow Germans really believe Churchill said. For example,
the only statistics you can trust are those you falsified yourself. I don't know if you ever heard that.
No, I haven't heard it, but I like it quite a bit. Can you give me another one?
The other one is when he was asked about his longevity. I mean, you know, he got pretty old, though he didn't live very healthy in the end. And he said, first of all, no sports. And both of these, if you go out on the street and ask Germans about this quote, well, they say, of course, that was Winston Churchill. And if you go to England and ask people about it, they probably won't know it. And that's an interesting thing to research.
And this is what you did, in fact, research. What did your investigation unearth?
Well, about the sports thing, basically what I could find out that before the war, so in his younger years, Winston Churchill was actually a real athlete. He did all kinds of sports at the elite school he went to, like cricket, polo, all your British sports that come to mind. And a real quote of him is, no hour that you spend in the saddle is wasted. So probably the Germans really got a picture from Churchill only after the war, this sort of like obese guy with his whiskey glass and a cigar.
Now, how about the other one, the one where he supposedly said, I don't trust any statistics, I haven't falsified myself?
Yes, this was kind of a slam against Churchill, right? There was a real PR war going on between Germany and Britain during the Second World War. And there was a real order from the government to portray the British and especially Churchill as a liar in the press. So I think that's how this image of Churchill, the guy who fakes statistics and falsifies numbers, got into the public image in Germany.
When you came out with the news for your fellow Germans that Winston Churchill really may not have uttered these lines that everybody knows by heart, what was the reaction?
Well, of course, astonishment. It's always if someone had believed something for a long time. But I don't think I can do away with it. These things are so strong. They stick and they get quoted in a political commentary because no one bothers to look up if that was original. And then you can't fight this. It will stick once it's out.
Yeah, you can't say, you know, he never really said that. You know, that makes you kind
of... No, and with other quotes, it's the same. I can't prove that they haven't said this. It's just not documented. And even if you speak to people who have all the speeches and know the biography, so it's highly improbable that it's original. But many of these quotes that you find in books are not true, but like well invented.
Yes,
you know, it fits to the image that you have of that personality, and so that's what people like.
All right. Well, exactly. Thank you for getting at the bottom of this, Christoph.
You're welcome.
Christoph Drösser is an editor and reporter for the German newspaper Die Zeit. And now it's time for Eating Sideways, the bit where we pick a foreign word or phrase that doesn't easily translate into English. Listener Megan Cusson sent this my way. Megan, if you're listening, thank you very much. And sorry if I mess up the pronunciation of your name. The email address that you gave me no longer works. In any case, Megan sent me a great Italian expression. Back to the Big Show's William Troop, who reveals all.
In bocca al lupo is a very, very common expression in Italy. And it means, may you end up in the mouth of the wolf. It's actually, believe it or not, an expression that means good luck, even though the direct translation means, you know, you're in the mouth of the wolf, and that's presumably a dangerous place because the wolf is going to bite you or eat you. But the full phrase is in bocca al lupo, and then the other person is supposed to answer crepi il lupo, which means may the wolf die. So it is good luck if you say the whole phrase all through, and this is a way that you can tell an Italian from somebody who just knows a little bit of Italian, because some people might say good luck just by saying in bocca al lupo, But if the other person doesn't answer, crepi il lupo, may the wolf die, then you've actually wished them bad luck.
Right, there you are, hanging in the mouth of the wolf.
Exactly. So you have to say the full phrase or you've actually wished them bad luck. It's kind of like saying break a leg here in the States. It's kind of a counterintuitive. If you say something bad that's going to happen, then it won't happen.
That's William Troup with this week's Eating Sideways expression, in bocca al lupo. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And I'll leave you with this.
This is Lisa Mullins from PRI's The World. So, where in the world do we go today?
Labadee, Haiti.
Andhra Pradesh, India.
Pyongyang, North Korea.
How about tonight?
Harare, the city that never sleeps.
The GeoQuiz Challenge puts your geographic smarts to the test. Click in and see how you measure up against contestants around the globe.
The answer to the GeoQuiz is the Chinese province of Liaoning.
The GeoQuiz Challenge from PRI's The World. Play it online at theworld.org.